Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're jumping into something truly fascinating, a deep dive into, well, the hidden workings of modern life. We're exploring the framework, the methods, and frankly, some pretty shocking findings from a book that really shook things up, Freakonomics. A rogue economist explores the hidden side of everything.
It's such a crucial read, isn't it?
Yeah.
Especially if you want to get past just, you know, nodding along with conventional wisdom. Our mission today is really to give you a shortcut into that way of thinking, that data-driven mindset.
Yeah, because this book really makes you look at the world differently. Not how we maybe wish it worked, but how the numbers suggest it actually does.
And why does that matter now?
Well, I think in today's world, with just so much noise, opinions everywhere, information overload, understanding this Freakonomics way of thinking, how to spot incentives, see through maybe statistical illusions, it's just invaluable.
It really is.
Yeah.
A tool for critical thinking, for maybe healthy skepticism.
Exactly. And, you know, to really get the book, you have to understand the team behind it, this unique partnership.
Oh, absolutely. That collaboration is key.
So first up, you've got Stephen D. Levitt, the quote-unquote rogue economist.
Yeah.
Brilliant guy, University of Chicago.
Right. And rogue because of his focus. I mean, he won the John Bates Clark Medal. That's a huge deal in economics, often leads to a Nobel.
Mm.
But he uses all that brain power, that rigor, not on forecasting GDP or stock markets, but on things like, well, crime, parenting, cheating,
yeah,
social stuff.
Yeah. His authority isn't about prestige. It's purely about the data. He follows it wherever it leads, no matter how weird the question seems.
He asks those uncomfortable questions, definitely.
Okay, so if Levitt's the engine driving the research,
mm-hmm,
who makes it readable? Who turns these complex, maybe slightly quirky papers into something everyone wants to pick up?
That would be Stephen J. Dubner, the journalist. He's a storyteller. He used to write for the New York Times Magazine. He's got this talent for translating Levitt's heavy analysis into stories that just grip you.
That combination is really the magic, isn't it? Levitt's analytical firepower, Dubner's accessible narrative style.
Totally. They bridge that gap between like dense academic research and just a really good thought-provoking read. They made behavioral economics entertaining, like detective stories.
Okay, so let's lay out the big idea, the central premise driving this whole thing.
At its heart, the book's thesis is pretty straightforward. You can take the tools of economics, specifically looking hard at incentives and analyzing data, and apply them to pretty much any kind of human behavior.
Mm.
And when you do, you find surprising truths.
The world runs on hidden rules, basically, and they're often the opposite of what you'd expect.
Exactly. And the book kind of lays out four big principles for this Freakonomics mindset. First one, incentives are everything.
Right. They're the cornerstone. Doesn't matter if they're economic, social, moral, incentives drive behavior.
Second principle, conventional wisdom. You know, the stuff everyone knows, it's often just wrong. Or lazy thinking.
Mm-hmm. It sticks around because it's convenient, maybe, not because it's actually true.
Then there's a slightly more cynical one, number three, experts. They often use their information advantage, the fact they know more than you, to push their own agenda, not necessarily yours.
Yeah, that information asymmetry.
So the fourth principle ties it all together. It's basically a call to action. Follow the data relentlessly. Question your assumptions, all of them.
And that framework lets them tackle this wild range of topics, right? Sumo wrestling, drug gangs, parenting, it all gets the same analytical treatment.
Yep. Anyone with a curious mind is the audience here.
Okay. Let's dig into some of those famous case studies, starting with incentives and cheating. So here's the question. What could possibly link Chicago school teachers and Japanese sumo wrestlers?
Seems like a stretch, right? But the book argues it's the same thing. High-stakes incentives leading to really clever cheating.
Tell us about the Chicago teachers first.
Okay, so in Chicago, they started tying teacher valuations, school funding, everything, to standardized test scores. Suddenly, the incentive for teachers to boost those scores became enormous. Their jobs were on the line.
So how did Levitt figure out they were cheating?
He developed this algorithm. It looked for weird patterns in the answer sheets. Things like a whole block of students suddenly getting a string of really hard questions right, but then somehow getting the easy ones wrong. Stuff that just doesn't happen randomly.
Ah, okay. So the data screamed cheating even when supervisors didn't see it.
Exactly. Calculated cheating exposed by the algorithm. Now, apply that same thinking to sumo.
Sumo wrestling. I mean, that's all about honor, tradition, right?
Supposedly. But again, data analysis found something fishy. It focused on a very specific situation. A wrestler goes into the final match of a tournament with a 7-win, 7-loss record. That next match is critical.
Why? What happens if they win?
If they get that H win, their rank jumps. Big implications for pay, prestige, everything. It's huge.
Yeah.
Now, statistically, facing an opponent who maybe already has 8 wins or more, someone who doesn't have as much riding on this specific match, that 7-7 wrestlers should win about, what, 50% of the time?
Makes sense. Pure chance.
But Levitt found they were winning almost 80% of the time in that specific scenario, against opponents who, frankly, had little incentive to try their hardest.
80%? That's not chance. That sounds like someone's throwing the mat.
Precisely. The data points towards a hidden deal, a quid pro quo.
And they proved it, or showed more evidence.
Well, the analysis went further. It showed that in the next tournament, when those same two wrestlers met again, the one who'd previously won that crucial 8th match often mysteriously lost to the guy who'd helped him before.
Wow. Paying back the favor, only visible through the stats.
Exactly. A hidden agreement, revealed only by the numbers, shows how powerful incentives can be.
Okay, so incentives drive behavior. What about power? How do people get it and keep it? Levitt says it's about information, or more specifically, the lack of symmetry in information.
Right. And this is where they draw that comparison that makes people uncomfortable at first. Comparing the Ku Klux Klan to real estate agents.
Okay, yeah, let's pause there. Comparing a hate group to realtors, how is that not problematic?
It's crucial to understand it's not an ethical comparison at all. It's purely analytical. Yeah. It's about the structure of how information asymmetry creates power.
Explain that. How did it work for the KKK?
In the mid-20th century, the KKK's power relied heavily on secrecy, mystique, hidden rituals, codes. That unknown factor made them seem scarier, more powerful. Then this writer, Stetson Kennedy, went undercover, infiltrated them.
Right, I remember this part. He leaked everything, didn't he?
Leaked it all, the secret handshakes, the passwords, the titles to the Superman radio show, of all places.
That's kind of, that's incredible.
And by making all those secrets sound completely ridiculous on national radio, it just punctured the mystique, turned fear into mockery.
So transparency destroyed their power base. Information was the weapon.
Exactly. Now shift that same mechanism information advantage to your typical real estate agent. Who knows more when you're selling your house, you or the agent who does this every day?
The agent, obviously. They know the market, buyer psychology, negotiation tactics.
Right. They have a massive information advantage. And what's their primary incentive? Is it really squeezing out every last dollar for you, even if it takes weeks longer?
Probably not. They want the commission, sure, but they also want the sale done quickly. Move on to the next client.
Precisely. Their main incentive is often speed. That extra few thousand dollars for you might only mean a tiny bump in their commission, but weeks more work.
So the incentive isn't perfectly aligned with the sellers.
And the data backs this up. Levitt found that real estate agents tend to keep their own houses on the market significantly longer and sell them for noticeably more money compared to their clients' houses.
Because when it's their own money on the line, the incentive shifts towards maximizing price, not just speed.
Exactly. Information asymmetry plus misaligned incentives.
Okay, let's shift gears again. Another myth tackled, the drug trade. We see movies, TV shows. The assumption is drug dealers are rolling in cash.
Yeah, the Scarface image, right. But the reality, according to the data they got access to, is completely different.
Where did this data come from? It seems hard to get reliable numbers on illegal activities.
It was pretty unique. A sociologist named Sudhir Venkatesh actually embedded himself with a major Chicago gang, the Black Gangster Disciple Nation. He gained their trust and got access to their internal financial records for several years, actual spreadsheets.
Wow. So what did the numbers show? Forget the myths.
It looked way more like a corporation, like think McDonald's, but incredibly dangerous.
A franchise model?
Sort of.
Yeah.
With a clear hierarchy. You had the top leadership, the board of directors making serious money, a few mid-level unit leaders did okay, but the vast majority, the street-level foot soldiers.
Right.
The ones doing the riskiest work.
Yeah. What were they making?
The average earnings were shocking, about $3.30 an hour.
$3.30, while risking their lives.
Yep, and the risk was immense. Over the 4-year period Venkatesh studied, the chance of a foot soldier being killed was about 1 in 4.
That's insane. Why would anyone do that for less than minimum wage?
Yeah, that's the key insight. It's what Levitt calls a tournament model. Like in big law firms or corporations, you're not really working for the low pay today. You're competing fiercely for the chance to maybe, just maybe, win the tournament.
Meaning, climb the ladder.
Exactly. Make it to those top spots where the money is astronomical. It's that tiny, distant possibility, that lottery ticket hope, that keeps people in the game despite the terrible odds and pay right now.
That makes a chilling kind of sense. Okay, this brings us to probably the most talked about, maybe the most controversial part of the book.
The crime drop.
Right. Crime plummeted in the U.S. in the 1990s, dramatically. And everyone had theories.
Oh, yeah? Better policing strategies, booming economy, gun control laws, changing demographics.
But Levitt looked at the data for all those factors and said, nope, important, maybe, but not enough. They couldn't explain the sheer scale of the drop.
So he proposed something else, something much further back in time.
This is the Roe v. Wade argument, isn't it?
It is, and it's vital we frame this carefully. The book's argument, based purely on statistical modeling, is that the single biggest factor driving the crime drop of the 90s was the legalization of abortion following the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision back in 1973.
Okay, let's be really clear here, because this is obviously incredibly sensitive territory, morally and politically.
Absolutely.
The book isn't making a moral judgment on abortion itself. It's strictly an economic analysis, right? Following the data.
That is precisely the book's approach. It attempts to set aside the profound moral weight and just look at the numbers. The theory goes like this. Legalized abortion led to fewer unwanted children being born.
Okay.
And unwanted children, statistically speaking, and this is the tough part, are more likely to grow up in difficult circumstances. Poverty, unstable homes, factors often correlated with higher crime rates later in life.
So the argument is that the generation that would have been reaching their peak crime-committing years in the early 1990s was smaller.
Essentially, yes. That cohort, statistically more likely to include individuals prone to crime due to adverse upbringing, was significantly reduced in size because of abortions that occurred nearly two decades earlier. Levitt's model suggested this effect, this demographic shift, was large enough to account for a major portion of that unexplained crime drop.
It's definitely a prime example of the Freakonomics method, finding a hidden, counterintuitive, and in this case, deeply controversial cause by looking far beyond the obvious explanations. We're just reporting the finding here, not endorsing the viewpoint.
Exactly. Following the data, however uncomfortable the destination.
Okay, let's pull back a bit and talk about the big themes, the main messages you can take away from this whole approach. Theme one has to be, correlation does not imply causation.
Yes, this is huge, especially in the parenting chapter. It's such a relief, in a way.
Just so.
Well, the book looks at all sorts of things parents obsess over, reading daily, museum trips, flashcards, whatever. And it finds that many of these activities correlate with successful kids, sure. But they don't necessarily cause the success.
So what does?
It's more about what the parents are. Are they educated? Successful themselves? Do they have lots of books in the house? Those things matter hugely.
The activities are often just signs or proxies for that underlying environment. The books aren't magic. They signal a family that values learning.
Right. So stop stressing about doing everything perfectly. Focus on who you are as a person, as a parent.
Okay, theme two. We've hit this a few times, but it's central. Incentives are everything.
The absolute bedrock. To understand why someone does something, anything, you have to figure out their real incentive. Forget what they say sometimes. What are the economic, social, or maybe moral forces pushing them?
I love that quote they use, comparing incentives to a bullet. A lever, a key.
An often tiny object with astonishing power to change a situation. Yeah, it captures how small shifts in incentives can have massive ripple effects.
And theme three is really the challenge the book throws down to you, the reader. Be skeptical of conventional wisdom.
Totally. If everybody knows something is true, put your antenna up.
Question it. Why does everyone believe it? Is it actually based on evidence? Or is it just convenient, comfortable, intellectually lazy?
It encourages that constant questioning. Don't just accept things at face value.
The book is also full of these memorable lines, these sort of maxims for thinking differently.
Yeah, some great takeaways.
I think one that really sums up the method is morality, it could be argued, represents the way that people would like the world to work, whereas economics represents how it actually does work.
That captures it perfectly. It's about that willingness to be, well, amoral in the analysis. Just follow the facts, setting aside wishful thinking.
And then there's the one about information, linking back to the KKK and the real estate agent.
Oh, yeah. Information is a beacon, a cudgel, a form of currency, a source of power.
It really highlights that understanding who knows who controls the information flow is critical to understanding almost any situation involving power.
And one more, maybe slightly lighter, from the chapter on naming children.
Right. They found that while a name reflects a lot about the parents, their background, aspirations, socioeconomic status,
the name itself doesn't really determine the child's future. It's a signal, not a script.
It comes back to those deeper environmental factors being more important than the surface details we might obsess over.
So how can you actually use this stuff? How does this Freakonomics lens apply to everyday life?
Well, first off, in your own decisions. Big ones, small ones, buying a car, negotiating a salary, even just figuring out a disagreement with someone. Ask yourself, what's the other person's hidden incentive here?
Right. If the car salesman says he's cutting you a deal because he likes your face.
Yeah, you know that's probably not the real reason. What's his actual goal? Commission. Clearing inventory. Meeting a quota. Look past the surface explanation.
And use it to be a smarter consumer of news and information.
Definitely. You see a headline. Study shows X causes Y. Your first thought should be, hold on, is that really causation or just correlation?
What else might be going on? Are there hidden factors? Distant causes, like the abortion argument for the crime drop. Don't just accept the easy answer.
And for parents, again, that big relief lesson we talked about.
Yeah, maybe stop sweating every little parenting technique or trend.
The data suggests focusing on the fundamentals, being educated yourself, being financially stable if possible, being engaged, being a happy person.
Those are the things that strongly correlate with good outcomes for kids. Be the role model.
So wrapping up, what was the most surprising thing or the biggest takeaway for you from digging back into this material?
For me, I think it's the reminder of how much intellectual humility this approach requires. You have to be willing to accept that deeply held beliefs about honor in sumo, about how drug dealing works, about what causes crime, might just be wrong, completely wrong.
And you have to be willing to follow the data, even when it leads to uncomfortable or politically charged places.
Exactly. It's about curiosity trumping conviction. In a way, letting the numbers speak, even if you don't like what they're saying, it really shows you the hidden architecture of things.
Yeah, for me, the lasting thought is similar. It's realizing that the biggest forces shaping our lives, our society, they're often not the obvious ones right in front of us. They're subtle, hidden, maybe counterintuitive.
Like incentives.
Yeah.
Or information flows.
Yeah.
Or long ago policy changes.
Right. So the book encourages you, really trains you to ask better questions, more unconventional questions, to always be looking for that hidden side of, well, everything.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Accatra Foundation.